I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. More than 1,000 union mine workers from the Wayumette Coal Mine in Tuscaloosa County, Alabama, are entering the fifth month of a labor strike. The miners are members of the United Mine Workers of America Union, which has a deep history in Alabama and in those very same mines dating all the way back to 1890. On Wednesday, mine workers held a large rally in Brookwood, Alabama. Thousands of UMWA allies came in from Illinois, Indiana, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Kentucky, and West Virginia to show solidarity with the Alabama miners.
We're just wanting back what we lost 5 years ago. We're wanting respect from the company. We're wanting our vacation time back. We're wanting our health insurance, the most important. And just, you know, some of the money that we lost also.
We're not backing down. We're fed up with it. All the, like, the scare tactics, all the stuff they're doing.
We're fighting for all workers across America, not just for us here at the mines.
Journalist Kim Kelly spoke to those folks in Brookwood, Alabama, and she joins me now. Welcome, Kim.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
So talk to me, what was the sentiment among the miners and family members at the rally yesterday?
There's a lot of good energy. One of the women I spoke to, Sherry, she's part of the Women's Auxiliary. She was saying that, you know, we get to kind of see the community support firsthand because we handle donations, we handle groceries. But a lot of the folks on the picket lines, they're just out there 24/7 kind of fighting the fight. They don't get to see the nice part, the solidarity part. So that was really a big deal for them to see all these folks from across the country coming out to support. Lots of media there. Lots of union leaders were there. It was just a really beautiful event, honestly.
So talk to me about the working conditions at the Wayumette coal mine. And we heard a little bit from some of the strikers there, but what is it they're asking for?
So the conditions there, it's, I mean, you're never going to find great conditions working in a coal mine. It's a very dirty, difficult job. But Wayumette, this is one of the deepest mines in North America. It's filled with methane gas, which has caused explosions, which has caused health issues for folks. The workers there, they're underground 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, sometimes seven. In the contract they have now, which was implemented 5 years ago when Wayumette came into the mines, they lost $6 an hour off their pay. They lost vacation days. They lost overtime.
Wait, pause. Go back for a second. Mm-hmm. They lost $6 an hour off their pay? How did that happen?
Well, when Wayumette came in, it was off the back of a bankruptcy from the former owners. And so there's a massive layoff. And when Wayumette came in, they're like, okay, we'll hire you guys back, but this is what we're going to offer you. You got to help us get on our feet. And then 5 years down the line, when we're in a better financial position, that'll trickle down to you. And of course it hasn't. And now the average wage there is about $22 an hour to work in a coal mine, 12 hours a day, 6 days a week.
All right. And I'm sorry, I interrupted you. What else did they lose in that fire, get hired back?
Sure. The biggest thing, as Braxton mentioned, the quote you played earlier, is the healthcare costs. Their healthcare costs have skyrocketed. And as I'm sure you realize, you know, coal miners, there's a lot of health conditions and medical issues and risk that those workers undertake. So their healthcare is a big deal. And now they're paying thousands more a month than they used to. So that's impacting the workers as well as their families, their children, retirees. That's a huge deal.
Okay. Are they being allowed to, I mean, they've been on strike for a really long time at this point. First of all, are they getting paid even that $6 an hour less wage during their strike?
Oh, no. The company isn't giving them anything but a headache. There is a strike fund that the UMWA has set up. And so as long as a worker completes their picket line duty, which is about, I think, 16 hours a week, they get a check for $700 every 2 weeks. And that adds up to about $1,400 a month, which is very helpful, but that is certainly not enough, especially because the majority of these workers are parents and supporting family members as well.
Now, when I heard you say the company hasn't given them anything but a headache, are they allowing them, at least in the context of the strike, to sort of strike in peace?
No, ma'am. They have been terrible. Honestly, I've been shocked. I've been covering this story since the very beginning. And the amount of hostility and aggression that the company has displayed is just truly shocking. I know of at least five documented instances of company employees, whether they're bosses or scabs, you know, contractors that were brought in, of running their cars and their pickup trucks into people on the picket line. Multiple strikers have been sent to the hospital.
What?
One of the strikers' wives, Amy, she was hit and she's still feeling it. You know, people are being hurt and the local police aren't doing anything. and the union is fighting to get anyone to pay attention and to help them. Like, this is, it's really scary. It's, we're really looking at another Harlan County down there.
Okay. When you say, first of all, that there are people striking peacefully in line, getting hit by cars, that you've been covering this now for months, that, I have to say, I'm a little surprised that I haven't, it's certainly been covered some, but why hasn't it been covered much more widely in the news? Is this just about being kind of pushed out by the, you know, headlines of COVID and other things like that?
I'm sure that's a factor. And I have a I have multiple theories about this. It's kind of been driving me nuts because I had been covering it and I'm so invested in the story. I think perhaps the fact that the industry they work in, coal, fossil fuels in general, it's a little harder to tell a nuanced story there or to drum up sympathy because it is such a complicated issue, right? And also, you know, it's a rural area in Alabama. There are a lot of assumptions that are made about folks in those areas. There are a lot of folks who are more conservative who are involved in this group. And I think most labor stores, there's kind of an implied underline of progressivism, right? And that's not necessarily the case here. Of course, the miners aren't a monolith. Like, everyone has, it's a very diverse group. But I think it's been a little tougher to get sympathy for a bunch of striking coal miners in Trump country than maybe it would be for another strike somewhere else of a different kind of people.
You know, it's an interesting point when you call it Trump country. I mean, obviously, Alabama predates former President Trump, as does, in fact, union activity in Alabama. I think some people might even be surprised to discover that there is this kind of a strong union in Alabama.
That's something I've come up against, too. Like, the labor movement in Alabama, they've had to fight even harder in some ways because the legislature is so red and so anti-labor and so conservative. You know, the labor history in Alabama is really incredible. You know, it goes back, as you mentioned, the UMWA has been there since 1890. There have been significant miner strikes. They've been involved in other massive strikes like the Great Uprising of 1934. There's the Mine Mill Workers Union. There's, I mean, we just saw several months ago, there's tons of coverage of how workers at a Amazon warehouse in Alabama, Bessemer, about 16 miles down the road, actually, they tried to organize a union. And that, you know, it didn't go the way we wanted it to yet, but they have a chance at a rerun now. Like, there's a lot going on. It's just, I think the fact that maybe it's in the Deep South and their legislators are so bonkers.
That's a technical term. That's a technical term.
I know that I'm on the radio is trying to mind my language. So yeah, they have to fight so much harder to get even an iota closer to what workers in a state like New York or California have to go up against. So I think it's incredible that they're still there and they're fighting this hard because no one is paying attention. And when you're screaming into the void, it can get kind of discouraging. But these folks are still going 5 months later.
I feel like I can tell you've been hanging out with some Alabama coal miners. You're like, this is just, it's just too much. Talk to me about the Biden administration. Obviously, the Biden administration has put significant emphasis on green energy. And as you said, coal mining has become a bit of a dirty word among progressives. But where would these, I mean, one, we're still going to need coal for a while. But if, in fact, the Biden administration is able to move us in an important way towards more renewable energies, where's that going to leave these workers in the long run?
So one aspect of this story that I think is important to emphasize is, as you said, you know, coal's not going anywhere for a little while. But the specific type of coal that they mine, metallurgical coal, is used to produce steel. And so the demand for that is sticking around even longer. Actually, all the coal that they mine is sent overseas to, you know, rapidly industrializing countries in Asia and in Europe. So they're going to be around even if the rest of the country switched to a fully green economy tomorrow. And that's something that I think folks there recognize. They also recognize that the industry as a whole is on decline and that, you know, perhaps they might need to think about other options. But those options just haven't been presented to them in a meaningful way. You know, it's hard to come up to someone who's worked in the coal mine, whose dad worked in a coal mine, whose granddad worked in a coal mine for 30 years and say, okay, we're just going to just have you building windmills now. Like, that's fine. That's not an acceptable compromise to some of these folks. There's a lot of pride and generational memory in those mines. And I think the government really needs to recognize that and recognize these coal communities whose entire lives are built around these mines and offer them something decent. You know, like, the UMWA fairly recently came out with a statement that was sort of a tentative support of Biden's green energy plans. They're saying essentially, like, okay, we're we get it. We're kind of down with this. We'll support you, but you need to make sure our people are being taken care of. That's the thing. They don't want to be left behind.
So you've gestured here, maybe more than gestured, towards the politics here. Is there any possibility that, you know, participating in a 5-6 month strike against a company that is sort of not being responsive in this way might actually shift some of the politics of these workers if, in fact, they were able to find an ally in the Biden administration?
You know, I almost wouldn't even say the Biden administration per se. The biggest amount of support that they've gotten throughout the labor movement, which is obviously majority more of a progressive body, like a lot of the support they've been getting are from local socialist groups and lefty groups. And those are a lot of the people who are donating and showing up to rallies and helping out. And I think, you know, the S word is not necessarily the most popular in some pockets of Alabama, but I think actions over labels, that's something that people are sort of recognizing. I think people's stances on the left or Democrats or whatever, people on the other side, if you will, they are softening because they're seeing, okay, well, nobody from the Republican world is reaching out to us. Our Republican senators aren't paying attention. Fox News isn't paying attention. All these people that we thought were on our side aren't saying a word. And here's the folks who are. So I'm sure that's making impact. I've had some really interesting conversations to that effect down there. Like it's people recognize and realize who shows up for them. And I think that if the Biden administration did kind of put a little effort in, you know, Biden made a whole video to tacitly support the Amazon workers. He hasn't done the same for these workers. No politicians have. I think it's a very ripe opportunity to for someone who actually cares to step in and be like, hey, look, maybe we don't see eye to eye on everything, but we agree that y'all should be able to feed your kids and make it to and from work every day and survive and thrive. You know, like there is an opportunity here. And I think a lot of people are blowing it, honestly. Like, where's Joe Manchin? You know, like, isn't this his whole thing?
Isn't this just his whole thing? Kim Kelly is an independent journalist and author of the forthcoming book, Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you for looking into this story. It's great.
Absolutely. Also, please know the Takeaway asked WarriorMet Cole for comment. We have not yet heard back from WarriorMet, but when we do, we'll post a response at thetakeaway.org. Now, if you've seen the show Superstore that ran on NBC, you know that most of the storyline revolves around the many labor issues affecting its characters. And much of the time, workers are trying to unionize while management tries to prevent those efforts.
Studies show that employees at a non-union facility are more engaged and happier.
Yeah! Don't try to come between me and Cloud Nine. That's my bae.
New reporting from the American Prospect tells the inside story of real-life anti-union action in a plant-based meat company in North Carolina, known as, and I swear this is the truth, No Evil Foods. Workers at No Evil Foods started a union drive in early 2019. And before the vote scheduled in February of 2020, management hired a consulting firm that specializes in union avoidance and held mandatory meetings for employees. Here's one of the No Evil Foods managers talking to workers in one of those meetings.
So why am I making all these points about the importance of investment dollars? Well, because it's a very real risk that having a union at No Evil Foods will greatly impact our ability to continue raising capital, which risks the survival of our business.
David Dayan, executive editor of the American Prospect and author of the recent article, Anatomy of an Anti-Union Meeting, walked us through the union drive at No Evil Foods and what has happened to workers since.
So No Evil Foods is a vegan, plant-based foods company. And their workers organized to have a vote on whether or not to join a union. The vote was in February of 2020, right before the pandemic. And prior to that, No Evil Foods, in association with a corporate consultant that specializes in union avoidance, did a series of mandatory meetings for all employees Which were pitched as sort of informational sessions to explain what union membership would be all about, at least from management's perspective. And this is a very common technique that's done during union drives. And I got to listen to about 5 or 6 hours of these meetings, and they were absolutely fascinating to hear the way in which it's almost a kind of psychological warfare that the company engages in to make the workers feel like a union would not operate in their interests.
Part of what was so stunning about your piece is, as you say, there is audio. We can actually listen to it. It's not just what the workers are reporting to us, but we can hear for ourselves. How in the world did you get this audio?
Well, workers taped it is the answer while they were forced to sit in these meetings. And we don't normally hear it. I mean, usually even union organizers are not allowed to be on site. It's employee only meetings. And sometimes you get snippets here and there and you hear about it, but this, to be able to hear 5 or 6 hours of it, you get, you know, these frames that keep coming up again and again. And one of the perfect examples is just this idea that there are employees and employers, and there's this nice, happy family relationship. And then this third party union comes in and is going to ruin everything. And almost the structure of these very tense mandatory meetings, this tension being built, you know, there's a relationship between that and the union almost being seen as the cause of that tension, which can only be relieved by voting it down. So it's a very interesting psychological almost dynamic.
For me, when I read about that frame and when I listened to it, now I acknowledge that there are some very important differences here, but it is not that different, just as a discursive strategy, than the strategy of Confederates prior to the Civil War, that there was an idea that the enslaved and their enslavers were actually all in a very harmonious social relationship, and that it was literally the Union that was coming in to kind of bust this up. And it was the same framework, of course. It was used with this notion of outside agitators, right, coming in to try to integrate the South. I mean, like, so much so from that script that I think what was most surprising for me is that No Evil Foods is presumably a progressive company.
Well, that's certainly their branding, their messaging. They, you know, obviously being vegans, they have this sort of relationship with living a progressive life. And they have these brands. Their fake chicken product is called Comrade Cluck. Their fake chorizo product was called El Zapatista until the people in Chiapas got wind of that, and then they had to change the name. But yeah, they have this messaging, and that actually, I think, helped them in this campaign to say, hey, we're just like you. We're progressive. We believe in helping our workers. We just think that the union is not right for us. That was sort of the way that they went through it. And that sort of messaging from management that they were actually progressive and willing to help the workers, I think helped carry them through.
So let me just begin by, in part, sort of taking the other position and saying, okay, are they right? Right? You know, one of the claims that No Evil Foods was making, that I could hear them make in the audio, is that you know, there wasn't enough money coming in revenue yet to be sustainable. So they had to get investors, and that if the union came in, they might lose investors. Is there any extent to which that's true, that they were informing their employees of something maybe their employees didn't know?
That's really skirts the line of being legal. I mean, it is illegal for an employer to say that if a union comes in here, we're going to shut down. So it was kind of clever the way that they sort of got that impression across the workers. They said, we're not going to shut us down. But our investors who help carry the business, they might pull out their money and that might shut us down. So it's pretty problematic to me to have that be the message taken away from this union drive, because there really are laws against saying that you're going to shut down a business if the workers decide to use their collective bargaining rights. So I mean, that's one of the main things there. I guess the second thing is that the idea that a startup company cannot afford to treat their workers well is almost in some ways belied by what No Evil Foods was trying to do. They did offer health benefits. They did offer a wage that was higher than the average wage in the region. They were able to provide this. And from the perspective of the workers, they just wanted the ability to organize so that they could have some say in how things were conducted in the workplace and some job security on the back end. And of course, that proved to be very prescient.
Indeed. And so let's talk about that timing a bit, because whatever else, whether it was on the line of being illegal, it certainly ended up being effective, right? Workers voted down the union just before the start of the pandemic.
That's correct. Yeah, they voted it down by a pretty wide margin.
And do you have a sense that decision was based primarily on what they had come to understand from these so-called informational meetings?
From what I know of talking to workers who were organizers, they were fairly confident that they had the votes to form a union prior to these meetings. And after it, all of the people who were on the fence just went in the other direction.
So obviously then the pandemic hits, and what happens to the workers?
Well, the pandemic hit, and there were questions about whether they could continue in very close quarters. No Evil Foods offered workers a pretty bad set of choices that had to be made within 24 hours, offering some severance money if people wanted to quit, but they would have to sign a non-disclosure agreement that would hold No Evil Foods harmless from a variety of potential violations. They could not sign the NDA and then get no severance and quit, or they could stay and there would be some hope of a pay increase later down the line, but only if workers had perfect attendance for 90 days. That is not a set of options that I assume would have been in place if there was a union on the other side. About 13% of the workers took the buyout. Many of the top organizers of the union effort ended up being fired for various reasons, claiming violations of work rules. One of them was because a woman was told her shorts were too short. So, you know, it seemed to be some retaliation. There was a settlement with the National Labor Relations Board that No Evil Foods had to pay $40,000 to two of the workers who were fired. And then the sort of coup de grace at the end here, in June, every worker at the plant in North Carolina lost their job. No Evil Foods decided to outsource the production of their products to a separate manufacturer and eliminated the need for this workforce. So obviously, if there was a union, there would be a negotiation, there would be warnings. Workers were given absolutely no notice. They didn't get any severance. The health benefits were immediately canceled. And all they got was a flyer for a job fair in the area. That was the only thing that they received. So it was almost sort of the perfect way of showing how important a union job would have been to a group of workers.
Are the business interest that is No Evil Foods, is it now free to just continue to do business in other states, cities, localities, maybe even right back here in North Carolina? Or is there any penalty for these actions?
Well, outside of the National Labor Relations Board settlements that resulted in a $40,000 payout, no, there is No Evil Foods is not a union facility. They were allowed to get rid of all their workers and outsource production. They, as of 2020, were in something like 5,000 stores, so you can still buy the products, and they're going on. And I think the story is kind of a lesson in the tactics that businesses use to prevent union membership, but also a lesson in why that union membership might be needed from the workers' perspective.
And so in your in this point that it's a lesson in it, what are some of the lessons that unions can draw? And I guess I'm thinking specifically that the unions in North Carolina, I'm thinking about the Smithfield, pork processing plant here in North Carolina. I think it took 10 years of some pretty aggressive anti-union activity overcoming that to finally establish a union there. So I can't imagine that any union organizers in this state didn't know that there would be resistance. But is there... are there particular lessons that we can draw from this experience for those who might be hoping to do union organizing in the future?
Well, as you say, union organizing is a game of inches. It's a back-breaking process, and it does take years, and it takes a lot of member education. I think what's interesting here is because we have this blueprint, we have this real-time real world example of the arguments that are made and the tactics that are used to try to bust a union. I think organizers can take a look at that and anticipate some of the things that would be done in their own workplace. And they can move to try to preempt those before they happen.
I want to go a little bit further south. Can you talk to us about what happened in the Amazon Union Initiative in Alabama and the the National Labor Relations Board's preliminary recommendation about that?
Yeah. So Amazon warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama was under a union drive. It was a several week long vote, mail-in vote. And Amazon won that election by a somewhat healthy margin. And the union, which is the retail workers union, decided to complain about tactics that were illegal. And they got a preliminary complaint from preliminary ruling, I should say, from the NLRB, saying that, yes, there were some improprieties here, and there might need to be a new election rerun at Amazon. Some of that involved anti-union meetings that were mandatory, much like at the workplace at No Evil Foods. Another part of that was a mailbox that was placed on the facility at the warehouse at Amazon that seemed to suggest that Amazon would know when people were voting and perhaps even who, you know, what side they were voting on, which would open them up to potential retaliation. So, I mean, I think that was a big part of the NLRB decision. But either way, it's notable because usually you don't see a lot of consequences come out of these kinds of severe tactics to prevent a union from forming. And to have it happen at a business like Amazon, which at this point has almost 1 million workers in the United States, could be very consequential.
David Dayan, executive editor of the American Prospect and author of the recent article, Anatomy of an Anti-Union Meeting. David, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We asked No Evil Foods for a comment on this story. Their response is posted at thetakeaway.org. We've been talking about labor union organizing, and I want to shift now to draw attention to a rift in the labor movement, police unions. Some want to push police out of labor unions because police unions commonly obstruct accountability. But others argue that law enforcement officers deserve the labor protections of unions and actually want to use collective bargaining to create blueprints for change. Joining me now is John Paul Smith. He is legislative representative with the United Steelworkers and a former law enforcement officer. John Paul, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Melissa. How are you?
I'm doing great. So first of all, talk to me as a former law enforcement officer about how it kind of lands with you when people make the argument that police unions should be broken up entirely.
Yeah, well, it's my personal opinion and also the stance of the AFL-CIO as well as my union that all workers deserve a union regardless of what their profession is, but also that a collective bargaining agreement should never be used as a shield for criminal activity. And I kind of have that same personal belief, you know, working as a police officer for a while and also as a member of the labor movement. I've been involved with the labor movement for almost 2 decades, and I went into policing late in life, around 32 or so, had already been involved in the labor movement for about a dozen years by then. So I really kind of brought those values with me. And a lot of, you know, folks go into policing at a very young age. And so they may not have that same kind of commitment to the labor movement when they start. And so part of it's just, you know, getting folks to kind of really grasp what being part of the labor movement is.
What drew you into law enforcement?
Well, to be honest, as a youth, I attempted to stay away from law enforcement a lot. And then I was working at a nuclear facility that was on the edge of shutting down, but had seen a lot of things in law enforcement in our country that I just didn't agree with personally, and particularly was motivated after I saw the death of Eric Garner at the hands of New York City police to do something about it myself. And, you know, I was raised with values to not, let's not talk about it, let's do something about it. And so I chose to do something about it and filled out all the paperwork and put in the application and went to the academy and became a police officer to police the way I envisioned policing should be done in our country, and did that for, you know, 5 or 6 years, and came back to the labor movement with an opportunity here in the legislative office with the steelworkers in Washington.
So given that you'd already had professional working experience, that you were already sort of had these union values, these kind of get her done values that you just talked about, when you were in law enforcement and even now, do you see problems with the current way that police unions deal with issues of police brutality?
I would say I see problems with the way some police unions deal with overuses of force and the way they communicate with the public. It's very localized. Police unions, a lot of people don't realize that although there's 13 affiliates in the AFL-CIO that represent police officers, along with the Service Employees International Union and the Teamsters, and that kind of made up our coalition. But there's also individual bargaining units within policing that are under umbrellas of other organizations. And so it's not a national network. And so part of what we've tried to do is to bring folks together to the table to really talk about some of these tough issues that we're dealing with and make sure that, one, the profession is upheld, that the people who are doing the job correctly every day are recognized, and two, that the folks who maybe should not be doing the job at all are held accountable, and we go forward to make our country a little better.
All right, John Paul, talk to me about what the blueprint for change is.
So last summer, after after we saw the outcry from the deaths of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, the AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka formed a racial justice task force. And that task force divided the work up into a few subcommittees, and one of those was on policing. And we noticed while we were doing this work, and I should have mentioned that the lead staff for that committee, and we noticed while we were doing this work that one of the voices from the table was missing. And that was of unionized police officers, the people on the front lines doing this work every day. We hear from mayors, we hear from police chiefs, we hear from lots of folks, we hear from community activists, we hear from the media, but we weren't hearing from the people doing the work. And so we kind of put this network together to let unionized police officers have a voice in driving for reforms, not excuses.
So I appreciate that. You know, I've spent a, you know, fair number of years doing, you know, various kinds of journalism and media, and I've consistently wanted to talk with officers who are, you know, currently working, and I am never able to. I can talk with former officers, but current law enforcement are typically barred or banned or simply highly reluctant to speak with media. Is that a union problem?
I don't even know that it's a union problem. I think it's just a culture of our country, but we're trying to change it. It's one of the things we're trying to do is change. We had, when our blueprint came out, CNN actually did an article on the blueprint, and a current law enforcement officer as part of our group spoke to them. And I'm happy to connect you with some of these folks too.
Kid, is there a way that unions themselves, in the collective bargaining work that they do, actually work in ways to create more accountability for police and greater trust in communities?
We think so. So part of our Blueprint for Change is a program called the Union Law Enforcement Accountability and Duty Standards, or ULEADS, because everyone loves a good acronym. And part of that program is peer accountability. And we have a roadmap for this in other industries, but we want to bring that culture change to law enforcement. And so part of bargaining is, you know, you bargain with employers to get time to do the training for this stuff so that we can institute this program amongst our members.
So that culture that you talk about is often held up as one of the biggest challenges. I mean, in the case of the murder of George Floyd, undoubtedly, it felt as though there was a culture there, that kind of thin blue line culture, that, you know, culture of silence. Can that really be changed through union action?
Well, that's our goal. And so I don't think it's just a police union culture or a union culture. I think, you know, in my opinion, in my life experience, it's been an American culture, right? That no one wants to be seen as the rat or the snitch. But we realize through the labor movement and unionized police officers that we only have two options. We either change our culture or we watch bargaining rights get legislated away state by state and municipality by municipality.
I think many of us are still shaken and so moved by what we saw from the testimony of the Capitol police officers. And yet some have also been critical, saying that the unions haven't supported those police officers or those law enforcement officers in the way that we've, you know, seen, for example, in some other cases. Where are the unions on what has happened with those Capitol police?
Well, first, I want to say that I watched that testimony, and those were four true American heroes that defended our democracy on January 6th, and want to give them the respect that is owed to them. Secondly, those two departments, I can't speak for those unions. They're not AFL-CIO affiliated, either the Capitol Police or the DC Metro Police unions. I can only speak for the work that we're doing within the AFL-CIO and our union to kind of hold this profession up while also holding bad actors accountable.
John Paul Smith, former law enforcement officer and legislative representative with the United Steelworkers, thank you for having this tough conversation and joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listening to The Takeaway, I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. At the end of June, Queen Latifah ended her BET Lifetime Achievement Award acceptance speech with a shout-out.
Ebony, my love. Rebel, my love. Peace. Happy Pride.
This moment was the first time Latifah publicly acknowledged her partner, Ebony, after many years of keeping her personal life private. And in many ways, this moment was a sign of the ways that hip-hop has changed since Latifah first insisted on ladies first back in the late 1980s. Today, the landscape includes highly successful artists who openly embrace their LGBT identities. Artists like Frank Ocean, I Love Maconan, Young M.A., and Lil Nas X. Now, despite these changes, some things remain troublingly the same. Rolling Loud Festival headliner DaBaby sparked widespread criticism after his homophobic onstage comments in Miami last month. DaBaby initially doubled down on his comments, but then he issued multiple apologies. But that hasn't stopped festivals, including Governor's Ball and Austin City Limits, from dropping the rapper from their lineups. Just when Black queer hip-hop fans were feeling safe embracing the music they love, the baby moment is a reminder that some of their favorite artists see them as less than human. Michael Jeffries is Dean of Academic Affairs and Professor of American Studies at Wellesley College and author of Thug Life, Race, Gender, and the Meaning of Hip-Hop. Thanks for being here, Professor Jeffries.
Thanks for having me.
So first, I want to start just with what I read as hip-hop having always been queer in various ways. And, you know, maybe this is sort of my attachment to New Orleans hip-hop and to Bounce and folks like Katie Redd and Big Frida. But I don't want to pretend that there hasn't always been important, like, openly queer artists and, like, queer musical forms within hip-hop.
Yeah, I think that's a really great place to start. This notion that we're just now getting to talking about the politics and performance of queerness in hip hop is a false notion, because as you said, from the very beginning, we know there have been folks involved in the culture who, if not publicly declaring themselves queer, have played with gender and performance in ways that we certainly can read as queer with the knowledge that we have today.
Right. And I love that language that you just use, the sort of the playing with queer identities, the performance of it. I think about Nicki Minaj, who, you know, literally had different gendered identities and characters. So she could become Roman, and she was just as willing to say that she might take your girl from you as that she might take your man from you.
Absolutely. And then if you look at people like Missy Elliott is another one, for example, right, where not only what she said on the track, the audio, but the visual, some of the visual performances that Missy had in her videos were pathbreaking and clearly kind of playing with the division between not only gender divisions, but also the division between kind of human and machine and present and future. So all of those kinds of experiments are truly queer experiments, if you take the broad kind of definition.
Right, of queerness here. And yet I'm wondering, in part, you know, starting with Latifah, talking about Katie Redd and Big Frida, going to Missy Elliott, I'm wondering if that capacity to move across those sort of narrow gendered binaries is something more available to women within hip hop or to femmes within hip hop than it is for men. Is there something particular about policing Black male queerness?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there are a couple of conversations to have here. One is, why is it that the folks who are able to cite as commercial successes, right, Latifah, Missy, why is it they happen to be women or femmes, right? And the answer is because when they move across gender lines or destroy kind of gender assumptions, they're kind of tilting toward masculinity, which is a more acceptable and publicly kind of sellable version of hip hop identity, right? So they're moving toward what the established commercial norm is, which is why when you have someone like Frank Ocean, who's really hip hop adjacent, he's not really a rap artist, or Lil Nas X, who I would define as more of a pop artist than a rap artist, doing some really radical and subversive things, they may be accepted as artists, but folks who are truly embedded in rap and hip hop communities, straight folk who are embedded in rap and hip hop communities, seem less quick to celebrate them, right, as the kind of dominant artists that Missy or Latifah were. So absolutely, we can't just talk about queerness without talking about what specific gender formations folks are moving toward and playing with. And masculinity remains the standard.
Andre 3000 is the one counterexample I feel like I can, you know, bring out here. But I'm wondering sort of how Andre was able to do that, if that was also about sort of playing with regional identity, with Southern identity.
Absolutely. I mean, you look at some of his aesthetics were certainly queer aesthetics when you look at the way he did his hair, the way he presented his body in videos. But from the very earliest moments of his career, his sexuality was already established, right? He came in as a kind of Southern player from Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And that kind of early music, that Southern playlist of Cadillac music that he produced, was clearly rooted in a lineage of masculinity and in many ways misogyny, if you look at some of the language on their earliest music. So by the time he started to get a little bit more experimental and courageous with gender, he already had a foundation that he was working from where he was beyond question.
Now, as much as I am a hip hop head and want to celebrate all of these ways that queerness has always showed up, the truth is vile and violent homophobia has also long been a part of hip hop lyrics, music, and community.
Oh, no question. And I think part of it is just, you know, part of it, and this isn't to make an excuse of all, part of what hip hop performance is doing, especially lyrically, is exaggerating to give oneself power through lyrical performance, right? And the kind of exaggerated forms of hyper-masculinity that we see play out in all kinds of ways, certainly suggesting you have the capacity for violence. And part of that violence is dominating other folk. And that form of hegemonic masculinity, of course, demands and includes, right, denigrating gay folk, denigrating queer folk for other gender identities, and denigrating women. So we shouldn't be surprised that as part of that kind of history of exaggeration, we see these performances. And not to excuse the violence at all, because this isn't just lyrical violence. We know that part of the reason this is so troubling is the real violence that LGBTQ plus folk are facing as a result of comments and beliefs like those articulated by DaBaby.
See, we're talking about the lived experience of violence for particularly queer and trans people of color. And I just kept thinking about the 2017 moment when Janet Mock, the author, the producer, had gone on The Breakfast Club, talked about her new book. And then 2 days later, the artist Lil Duval is on and makes a point that if he were so-called tricked by a trans woman into having a sexual relationship, that he would be willing to kill her and, in fact, required to kill her the next day. And Janet's book was used as a prop in that conversation. And I think for me, that is one of those stomach-turning moments that I've really never gotten over with hip-hop.
I mean, I don't think we have to go through the litany of statistics when it comes to Black trans folk who have been assaulted, Black trans folk, especially Black trans women who have been killed. When you look at the rates of Black trans homelessness or unsheltered, problems with shelter security, housing security, food insecurity among those populations. But we know empirically that this is one of the most vulnerable populations we have right now, right? And the reasons for that are varied, right? I think we have to start with poverty as a whole. And when you look at some of the challenges that Black LGBTQ plus folk face, you can't separate them from the poverty that Black communities are kind of dealing with on a day-to-day basis. And then when you overlay that with the emphasis on a politics of respectability when it comes to gender, when you overlay that with a kind of masculine anxiety around sexuality, that's when you get some of the really devastating reactions and violent attacks on folks who belong to those communities.
Is there any reason to think that hip hop is more homophobic than country music, rock music, or heavy metal?
I'm always sort of slow to make that comparison because we know that hip hop is often held up as a target so that America doesn't have to face the institutional reasons for ills like homophobia, transphobia, gun violence, right? Hip hop is an easy scapegoat. It's part of a racist moral panic. So if we can put it all on hip hop, if we can put it all on the cultural pathology of Black folk, then America doesn't have to face its institutional responsibility. So we have to acknowledge that all of these issues are institutionally rooted. Having said that, there's also some evidence, right? Like if you look at Black religiosity, and the relationship between Black religious beliefs and beliefs about LGBTQ folk, LGBTQ plus marriage, et cetera, that there is a link between Black cultural practices and at least the expression of anti-LGBTQ plus politics and political beliefs. So I think we have to be able to have both conversations, right? Not allowing it to turn into a racist moral panic that Black folks are fully responsible, but also not shying away from what we know are real problems in Black cultural institutions, whether it's the music industry or the Black church.
And the Black church, like, of course, like hip hop, an institution that is queered in multiple ways, not only performatively, but relative to the folks who are laboring in those, you know, religious spaces, and yet also not always or often, right, not only not acknowledging, but not being able to manage the realities of people's lived experiences.
Oh, no question. I mean, we have so much research on this that I know you know well. Folks like Kathy Cohen, Riley Snorton, who have written wonderful books and essays about the really vexed relationship between queerness and the Black church. And we have a failure historically in this country, a failure of the leadership of the Black church to take this issue head on, right, in the kind of political sense. And then culturally, we have the kind of, you know, the dissonance of the experience of being in Black religious spaces where Black queerness is celebrated, as you noted, performatively in so many ways. And Black queer folk are given positions of prominence and those people are celebrated conditional, right, mm-hmm. on the fact that they don't allow their gender and sexuality to come out too publicly, too proudly. So there's a lot to unpack there. And we're fortunate to have colleagues who are working on the front lines of those issues.
Sometimes when I go back and listen to the hip hop that I grew up on, you know, because I do like to make fun of young people and the terrible hip hop they have now. But sometimes when I go back and I listen, I hear a level of homophobia that I don't even think I heard, that it did not register to me, you know, at 15, at 16, when I was hearing that basically all you had to do was to call someone gay. All you had to do was to call someone a punk. And that itself was the full diss. It feels like that is generally and genuinely different now in the music. And that someone like DaBaby, who makes the kinds of ignorant comments that he made, does get policed in important ways. Am I being too optimistic about the trajectory?
You know, I think we want to be careful here. I actually agree with you. And I think that the reason I agree with you is just kind of taking stock of the number of commercially successful artists who have been able to declare more publicly their LGBTQ plus identity, right? We already ran some of them down, but also folks like Young M.A., Tyler, the Creator. So you don't have to go very far within commercially successful hip hop to find a more kind of broad acceptance. Having said that, I think we want to be careful not to discount the lived experience of LGBTQ plus folk who are embedded in hip hop communities and may feel very differently about it, right? Like that commercial success that I recognize might not mean much to those folk who are going to the concerts, who are engaging in, you know, discussions through social media or on message boards online and are really embedded. And they might not want to hear about my impression of the progress we've made, right? They may have a very, very different experience.
And not only for the artists, but for those of us who love hip hop. I mean, this has always been sort of the challenge of hip hop feminism. Like, I both grew up on the music. I adore the music. And sometimes there are days I just have to turn it off because it actually is too much for me to have to listen to the violence, you know, displayed against Black women. And again, not just lyrically, but in lived experiences like Megan Thee Stallion's, you know, experience. So I'm wondering about fans, about listeners, and what it means to love something that doesn't love you back.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that folks, at least within rap and hip hop, have been wrestling with for decades, for generations, right? For all of the reasons that you mentioned. Fortunately, I think we have so many more choices and ways to access music today that we can actually seek out choices and artists that don't force us to kind of, you know, deal with the guilt, the pain of engaging with that music. And in some cases, right, enjoying the misogyny. I mean, for those of us who grew up, it became very, very difficult to separate that high that you would get from the music you would listen to, from the high that you would get from indulging in a kind of really dangerous and hurtful form of masculinity, right? So I think that we've all got to be more careful, and we have choices now on the commercial side, or at least on the kind of consumer side, that mean we can go out and pick and choose things a little bit better than we could. But you're right. I mean, I think for many of us, these are still day-to-day choices, and breaking the habit is hard. Like, it's the fish who doesn't realize that they've been swimming in water their whole life. We've been breathing this stuff in from the time we first listened to music. This is socialized into us. And we absolutely have to take on the responsibility of breaking out of these habits, not only breaking out of them, like achieving a kind of neutral position, but speaking out against it unapologetically when folks like DaBaby kind of violate the principles that we stand for.
Michael Jeffries is Dean of Academic Affairs and Professor of American Studies at Wellesley College and author of Thug Life, Race, Gender, and the Meaning of Hip Hop. Thanks so much, Professor Jeffries.
Thanks for having me.
That's all we have for y'all today. And I don't know about you, but I'm about to spend my afternoon making a playlist of the best genderqueer hip-hop tracks. In fact, I'd love to know what you would include on your playlist. So send us a tweet at The Takeaway, or record a voice memo on your phone and email it to us at takeawaycallers@gmail.com. And of course, always call us with your show ideas at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.